From KQED Public Radio, this is Capitol Notes, our weekly look at California politics and public policy. I'm John Myers from KQED, and Anthony York, the editor of Capitol Weekly, yawning.
No, it's not a yawn.
Into his microphone.
That's
well,
not
you just
true.
Told me you're out, off the afternoon coffee.
Yes. And this is, you know, whatever day afternoon.
Yeah, right. It's Thursday. We
okay.
put it out on Friday.
Okay.
We'll tell the public now, finally, how we do these
The
tapings.
Secret is out.
So how many days have you been off the coffee?
Not off the coffee. I had to have
just
espresso in the morning.
Off.
Yeah, just one espresso in the morning and a lot of green tea.
You look tired.
Thanks.
You always like this part at the beginning where I like try to come up with some random small talk before we start talking about politics.
Great.
Yeah, it's great.
And luckily our listeners can't see that I'm in my pajamas.
Yeah. Lucky for them, unlucky for me.
Yes. The footed bunny. No, never mind.
I was going to let you keep going. All right, so let's talk about the budget. Hey, there's a topic we've never talked about before.
Speaking of nap time.
Yeah, speaking of things that are just too strange to even talk about. So we're back in session here in Sacramento. The new legislature was sworn in on Monday. I keep forgetting how many new members I should call it, since some of them aren't really new.
There's 11 Republicans, one of whom was a former Senate Republican leader.
Mm-hmm. And now he's in the Assembly.
Right. But he was the Assembly Republican leader the Senate Republican leader in the 80s.
They don't get lost. 11 Republicans.
11 Republicans, including Jim Nielsen, and 18 Democrats, including Wes Chesbro and Tom Torlakson, who both served in the state Senate.
Immediately. No, well, one of them immediately before the Assembly won a couple of years ago.
And Torlakson used to be in the Assembly, only has two more years of Assembly eligibility before he runs for Superintendent of Public Instruction.
The circles are all
29.
Okay.
29 is the number.
Okay, so a reasonable number of new lawmakers.
A couple dozen.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
So they were sworn into office on Monday, and as well with the returning veterans of the legislature. And no rest for the weary, with the governor declaring a fiscal emergency right off the bat and calling a special session of the legislature to deal with this unending problem with the state budget and the $11 billion gap between revenues and expenditures. In the current year, $28 billion over the next year and a half. I feel like this has all been said before, but it bears repeating because it's serious. And the point is, here we are at the end of the week. And what happened? We didn't really get much. We had a little flurry of discussion about it on Monday, and that was it.
Well, I mean, keep in mind that we're dealing with 27 people now who are still learning where the bathrooms are, how to vote. They're still staffing up, how to introduce a bill. I mean,
how not to vote has been proved in previous legislatures.
How to ghost vote.
That's a different podcast.
That is indeed. Conversations are ongoing. I saw Assembly Republican Leader Mike Vallines coming out of the governor's office a couple of times, actually. It's like he was living down there this week. And the leaders are talking to each other, and they are trying to sketch out the framework of a deal. That said, there is no deal, and there seems to be a continuing divide over the types of cuts, the severity of the cuts. The best that I can tell, the Republicans' concern with the Democratic package that came up for a vote a couple of weeks ago was that the cuts were not ongoing cuts. They were one-time cuts to programs that would need to be cut again in the following years.
Thus the reason they kept calling them not real cuts.
Right.
Or something to that effect, yeah.
Now, but I do get the sense talking to Republicans, even talking to Republicans in the building, that there is a growing consensus that some type of new revenue stream is going to be required, and that might include tax increases. But, Republicans have a list of things that they want if they're going to put up votes for new taxes.
And that list is not a list of new things. I mean, these are really things that have been talked about now for months. I mean, that list really, most from what I've seen on that list, dates back to the summer budget impasse, does it not?
These are
things about overtime rules for the way businesses can do, four 10-hour days instead of 5 8-hour days to incur overtime. I mean, there are things like that we've seen before.
Right. And, delays in the adoption of the scoping plan, the plan to implement AB 32, the greenhouse gas legislation, postponing the implementation of new diesel rules that the Air Resources Board is currently considering. Now, how the legislature can agree to postpone, I don't know exactly how that works, but
someone will tell you.
Yeah, I'm sure. Perhaps a bill would override. Anyway, moving on. But and also a spending cap. I mean, this is something that Republicans have talked about for a long time, of trying to ensure that that structurally that we don't end up in this problem again, where we've spent a lot more money than we have. So that's where the conversation stands now. Last I checked, and as for any real breakthrough, it still remains elusive.
I wonder though. If the spending cuts are, what cuts you get and how you get them are still a topic of discussion, and that's something that's got to be resolved, wouldn't it seem the revenue problem is even a bigger one to overcome? Because, it's great for people to say we might need some new revenue, but where? What proposal that's been out there might right. someone actually decide they'll finally put their names on?
And the problem with this now, what the Republicans are saying is, hey, look, we all know that tax cuts – or tax increases now are about the worst thing you can do for the economy. I mean, look at what's going on in D.C. We've talked about this before. Even President-elect Obama is delaying the repeal of the Bush tax cuts, right? So, economists don't think that raising taxes in tough economic times is a good idea. And the Republicans are talking about a stimulus package, about ways to sort of give the economy a shot in the arm. And so you're dealing with sort of conflicting impulses here at the same time. You need revenue because the state's on track to run out of money by the end of February. At the same time, you don't want to you don't want to hurt the people that make the economy go. So, and you're trying to jumpstart the economy by putting more money into people's pockets. So it seems like there's going to be a lot of redistribution going on here, whichever combination of cuts, stimulus and tax increases is eventually adopted.
Well, just to be a pain in the rear end, let me try to recount for a moment the number of tax proposals or the actual tax proposals that we've heard about over the last several months. We have heard about a sales tax increase from the governor.
Yes. 1.5%.
1.5%, sometimes temporary, an expansion of services that are covered under the sales tax to therefore right. increase the base of sales tax revenues. From Democrats, we've heard about everything from in the summertime, we heard about the higher income brackets, again, and a tax increase.
Right.
We've heard about the vehicle license fee, which we can talk about in a moment, the dreaded car tax, bringing it back up to its full 2% of a vehicle's value.
Mm-hmm.
We have talked about a proposal to freeze modifications in the indexing of income taxes, which effectively raises people's taxes next year, though some people would call it a suspension of a tax cut.
Right.
Depends on how you define it. Trying to think of the other major revenue-raising proposals that have been put out there. Then there was the plan that some Republicans were floating in the summer of borrowing, which is actually not a revenue-raising, but it's a temporary revenue-raising, borrowing money temporarily from Prop 42 transportation, Prop 1A local government,
right.
Prop 10 tobacco tax money, something in there to get money that's sitting in a pot. I'm trying to think of if there's any – I can't really come up with any other substantive big revenue thing that has been talked about around this capital.
There was a list of revenue, more revenue accelerators,
right.
but they were smaller.
Right.
But those are all amnesty.
Those are all the big ones.
Right.
Those are all the big ones. And it's hard to see a consensus developing around any of those, which again then makes me say, if not those, what? Because you can talk about the cuts and people can keep talking about the cuts, but at some point they've got to figure out what revenues they would be willing to go up on.
Right. Well, and remember, the definition of consensus now has changed. I mean, there are 51 Democrats now in the Assembly, three shy of the two-thirds needed to pass this budget. And so presumably, it would be Mike Vallines voting for whatever deal is reached. The budget vice chairman, Roger Nilo, would probably be asked in his role as vice chairman of the budget committee to vote for whatever deal is reached. And you need one other Republican in the Assembly. So that's a consensus of three Republicans in the Assembly.
Thereby giving all the other Republicans cover on voting for a tax increase.
And assuming that all the Democrats go up. You know, there are a lot of Democrats now who have been elected in marginal districts. I mean, look at Alison Huber in the Lodi area, who was elected by 500 votes in a seat.
And didn't get the keys to her office until the night before being sworn in. Right. So that's a very swing district.
And it's going to be a tough vote for her to put up. But, you know, I think she's going to have to. And she's probably going to want some cover that, you know, that there are more than just the bare minimum of votes up. But in the Senate, you know, you've got the same situation. You only need two Republicans to vote for to reach a two-thirds threshold, assuming that all 25 Democrats go up on the vote. So, you know, we're talking about five people, essentially, who need to okay some combination of revenue increases. Now, you know, how that gets negotiated politically is another matter. And, of course, the leaders have to be wary of cutting a deal their caucus doesn't support, and they could lose their job as leader.
And that's part of the problem, too, because it's not always just needing five people. I mean, let's take the Senate, for example. Let's remember back to two summers ago, one and a half summers ago, where the Senate Republican caucus had come up with the rule of eight. Rule, which you had to get a majority of the 15 members of the caucus to agree to something before they let two go up on a budget deal.
Right.
So and the point is you can, you're right. It's technically it's five, but it's five plus whatever deals have to be struck in private to get those five to vote yes.
And I think, you know, because of the way a lot of these districts are drawn and because of term limits, and these are, you know, newly elected officials who don't have a strong relationship with their voters, you know, they're relatively new, many of them. That they're concerned that if they put up a vote for tax increases, they're going to get a primary challenge in a Republican primary in 2 years. That's a very real concern. And so, you know, something has to be done to try to offer some cover. Now, there are no guarantees. You know, you can't clear the field per se, but you know, I think that's part of the political calculus here.
Isn't that a place, though? Let's take it from a Republican standpoint. And I know that Republicans think they are always talked about more than Democrats about having to, you know, swallow some bitter pill when it comes to a budget. But staying on them for a moment. Sorry, Republicans. But isn't that the kind of place where you talk about a primary challenge or some angst with the rank and file Republicans? Isn't that a place where the governor theoretically should be able to come in and say this person did what was right, you know, and campaign for that person in a primary and say, you know, don't blame the, you know what I'm saying? I mean,
yeah,
we're about to get to the point of whether the governor has that kind of relationship with fellow Republicans.
Right.
But theoretically, a Republican governor would be the person who could come in and say, I will take care of you in that kind of situation.
Theoretically, but I don't know that this governor can guarantee that. I mean, how much sway does Arnold Schwarzenegger have in the, you know, the reddest parts of California?
Right.
You know,
although the poll that came out on Thursday, on the day we're taping this, last night, Wednesday night, that came out from the Public Policy Institute, when you look at the governor's approval ratings, with Republicans, it's still pretty strong.
Right.
With Republicans surveyed, which sometimes makes people like me wonder if legislative Republicans are more difficult on the governor than rank-and-file Republicans around the state. I don't know.
Perhaps, and that gets into the relationship question, which is
what you wrote about this week. That was my perfect little segue into Capital Weekly, Anthony York's piece on
CapitalWeekly.net.
Oh, sorry.
On the relationships between the governor and not just the legislative leaders, but individual legislators, you know, that
relationships or lack thereof,
right? And that, you know, the governor has been playing on this national stage. I mean, he called this summit in Los Angeles a couple of weeks ago this global warming summit, which many dismissed as kind of a photo op. This week, you know, he was meeting with the president-elect with a group of governors talking about economic stimulus that the federal government can provide to the state. I mean, that's certainly, you can make the case, that is dealing directly with the current budget problem. But the point being that he was not here for the swearing-in of the new members. None of the new members.
Of course, to be fairness with that, he got fogged in L.A.,
right. Well, but he was planning on coming up here and calling his fiscal emergency.
Yeah,
right?
But that's what happened. He got fogged in on that Monday
morning. Metaphor.
Fogged in. Yes. Anyway, go ahead. Good one.
And that, you know, but just more than that, that the governor has not called any of the new legislators, certainly none of the Republicans. And that this is a guy who is so good and so charming in person and has so much charisma and personality that I'm not saying that, you know, inviting somebody over for dinner is going to guarantee a budget vote, but it doesn't hurt to have a reservoir of goodwill. And I think that that's part of the frustration now is the real deterioration of these personal relationships. You know, a lot of it's the governor and then the churn of term limits. I mean, we've now had in the last 2 years a complete turnover of the big five, except for the governor. Is that right? 2 years?
I'm thinking how long Mike Vallines has been Republican leader.
Wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was 2 years because he took him out right after the election last time. And now Vallines is the grizzled veteran in the room. We have a new speaker, Karen Bass, a new Republican leader in the Senate, Dave Cogdill, and now a new
most recently a pro tem in the Senate.
Right. That was this week, Daryl Steinberg. So as you know, with that constant cycling of personalities and individuals, and then you know, and then we've got new members in the Senate, new members in the Assembly, and so they have to get to know their caucuses and be able to speak for them. It gets complicated.
Well, it's interesting that you said that about term limits because I know in the piece that you worked on, capitalweekly.net.
With an O.
As opposed to Capital Notes, which is an A, which is our blog. But anyway.
Spell notes with an A? No, never mind.
Da-da-ch. But I know you wrote about looking at the relationship that Pete Wilson, former governor, had with lawmakers in the legislature at that time, and then also looking at the difficulty that Gray Davis had with members of the legislature, which maybe we're seeing some of that in Schwarzenegger. Right. But it's interesting when you lay that transparency on top of the era of term limits, how convenient. The era of term limits really has kicked in during the Davis and Schwarzenegger eras and not so much as in the Wilson era.
Right. And you know, I mean – with all due respect to the former governor, Pete Wilson was not necessarily known as Mr. Personality, you know. But it's just the little things, as Mike Vallines says in my piece today. He says, you know, that he worked for Wilson, Vallines did, as a staffer, and that Wilson was always good at remembering birthdays and remembering spouses' names and writing personal notes. Just the little touches that, you know, are essentially they're the small touches that in any business, but certainly the business of politics, which is based on relationships. It's just good practice. And you know, and early on, the governor was very good at that. And he seems to have gotten distracted, whether it's just, you know, being exacerbated or otherwise distracted. You know, he seems to have gotten off the mark a little bit.
Hmm. And he, of course, he did give them little presents this week, right?
Yes, which somebody suggested to me are available in the Capitol gift shop, the pillbox Capitol thing.
Oh.
I don't know if that's true or not.
Let's rush over there and find out. But they don't have the signature of Arnold Schwarzenegger on the bottom.
Signature. There's that.
And so, right, there are little Capitol domes that open up. And I think my question was, you know, gee, they're empty. How perfect a metaphor for the Capitol.
And I was thinking, hey, it's a pillbox. What a perfect metaphor for the Capitol.
But they all got a little gift from the governor. But as you were saying, there are people who wonder, could he do more? And I think you do raise an interesting question. Which is, could you know, given where that relationship is now, can you undo that? Can you actually get to these folks? I mean, someone raised that with me just today. You know, is it too late to get to those folks? Of course, you've got a lot of new folks that maybe it's not too late to get
to. Well, that's just it. I mean, you've got 11 new Republicans in the Assembly. You know, you've got a whole crop of new people in the Senate who, many of whom have been, I think all of whom have been Assembly members before. But still, I do think not all of them have dealt with the governor. Tony Strickland now in the Senate, he hasn't been here since Schwarzenegger's been here, has he?
Yeah, he was in the Assembly.
No, his wife is now in her third term. Anyway.
This is really bad when we don't know this before we go on the air.
Because
someone's going to, like, harass us.
Because Strickland ran statewide in...
Make your broader point.
Six.
It's okay. Make your broader point. Yeah.
There is something of a reset. Yeah, keep me on track. There is something of a reset button that comes with a new legislative session, especially because of term limits. And it's a new opportunity. And, you know, the governor has been pretty good about learning lessons from his past, perhaps swinging too much in the other direction. But, you know, he learned from the mistakes of the special election in terms of adopting a hardcore partisan Republican agenda and how it was a tough sell for California voters. He perhaps swung too far the other way, hiring Susan Kennedy and adopting an aggressive Democratic agenda on things like the environment and the minimum wage. But you know, the governor's a pretty good student, and when he's paying attention, and it'll be interesting to see. I don't think it is too late to start building some relationships and see how that works.
And on that subject of does the governor learn from things and modify his positions on things. I want to go back to one of the revenue issues that we talked about just briefly, because I have a piece that'll air Monday morning on the California Report, public radio station statewide, californiareport.org.
KQED.org.
Well, californiareport.org is the quickest way to find it. But anyway, I have a piece that I filed that looks at the vehicle license fee, which the Democrats have put back in their proposal for raising revenues somewhere on the tune of about $5 billion over 18 months, would reinstate it to 2% of a vehicle's value, where it currently is at 0.65% of a vehicle's value. We all know the long, tortured history of the VLF, the dreaded car tax, which I won't get into, which, though, was the signature issue of the Arnold Schwarzenegger campaign in the 2003 recall election. There are a lot of people who think the VLF is a better vehicle for raising taxes. Well, that's nice. I didn't even intentionally do that. But it's a better vehicle for raising taxes, if you have to do it, than a sales tax, which is more regressive,
right,
or an income tax, which you can't really count on. The value of vehicles stays pretty constant. It's not that challenging. But it would require a major rebranding or rethinking on the part of Arnold Schwarzenegger, who made his political name on running against that car tax, and in addition to getting votes for Republicans in the legislature. And I think, you know, stepping back and just now looking actually at the car tax itself, you would have to think by the time we finish this discussion this year, we will know whether the car tax is, as I said in the piece, really the newest third rail of California politics. I mean, we're going to know one way or the other after this debate is over whether it's part of joins Prop 13 and school funding as things that you can't politically touch because it's just too volatile.
And remember, this is a tax that was reduced from the 2% level just 10 years ago.
Right. And was at that 2% for 50 years.
But that went right. But when the car tax was rolled back, when the VLF was rolled back from 2% to 0.65, there were economic triggers that if the economy went off the cliff, that the car tax would come back, right? I mean, that
theoretically, that's what Davis tried to do and got in a world of trouble for.
But yeah. Right. But now, you know, while there was some argument about how far off the cliff we were in 2002, 2003, I don't think anybody's arguing now what's going on.
Right.
You know, and so there is a case to be made, although it would, of course, be the ultimate irony if this governor who
smashed a wrecking ball on beat-up cars
in L.A.
brought out Count Cartaxula in 2005, which has to go down as one of the worst PR stunts, unfortunately.
Yes. I still can't find a picture on Google Images, so anybody out there who has a picture of Count Cartaxula, anybody who can say Count Cartaxula,
email it to Anthony at Capital Weekly. But no, you're right. It would be the ultimate. But again, under that discussion point of is this a governor who can find a way to see how things change, and could he convince people that things changed? Even though, again, you've got to imagine talk radio and everybody would just go bonkers if you tried to reinstate it to its full, which would be effectively, again, would be tripling it.
I'm not sure that talk radio speaks for I mean, you know, it's an important constituency, certainly. But we'll see. And it also, remember, I mean, the governor may not be running for anything anymore. I mean, I certainly he's concerned with his image, but I don't know that he needs to be in a place where he has to be able to win a statewide election. I mean, there's a U.S. Senate seat open in 2010.
That doesn't seem likely, though.
No, I just, you know, can't really see it.
Yeah.
And even so, I'm not sure at this point if how many Californians would have, you know, a real knee-jerk reaction. I mean, I don't know. I think it's a real open question. Given the economic situation, how many Californians would have a real visceral reaction to the VLF going back up?
Well, and as you alluded to when you talked about the way that it could have been increased before, that all changed in 2004, when it all got kind of rewritten and tangled into all these other things with the way that, because for people who didn't know this, and I think a lot of voters didn't know it, all the money for the VLF went to local governments, essentially.
Right.
And it went for important local government services, police and protection and, you know, public service kinds of things. And the state has been subsidizing local government ever since to make up the difference. Yeah, the infamous backfill, as we call it at the Capitol. And that's difficult to undo now because the law was changed in 2004 about how all that happens. So it would take a whole lot of things there to fix. But the other revenue thing I was going to talk about briefly, and we alluded to it too, just because the governor was in D.C., or in Philadelphia, more precisely.
Right.
He was in Philadelphia this week meeting with other governors, other Republican governors, and or is it just all governors? The National Governors Association.
Yeah, it was National Governors.
Sorry, wasn't just Republicans. And President-elect Obama was at the meeting. Saw the governor, shook hands with the governor and chatted with him, and apparently had some brief discussion about infrastructure funding, which was the governor's big message there.
Right.
And the governor wants help from the federal government. Of course, he doesn't want to call it a bailout from the federal government. He doesn't believe it's a bailout.
It's an investment.
Yeah. There's a semantics argument going there.
Right.
But he was saying that, I think, to differentiate from what some Democrats have suggested in money to actually help ongoing programs be funded.
Right. Right. And what the governor's saying is that there are $28 billion worth of infrastructure projects, roads, highway projects, things like that, that are ready to go.
In California.
In California. And that if the federal government provides that money to the state to get those projects going, that means new jobs, you know, for engineers, for construction workers. And I forget the number the governor put out. For every $1 billion spent, I think 18,000 jobs. Right? That's the number being thrown around.
I'd like
by
to
the
check that number, but nonetheless.
Right. And I don't know how you would check that number.
I don't either.
But it is a number that's out there.
But this is all part of the theory of a stimulus to stimulate the economy.
Right. And so the two main areas now, the governors are sort of making a coordinated pitch to the federal government on what a stimulus package for states would look like. Number one is the bailout, or excuse me, the infrastructure investment.
Whoops.
Wow.
Wow, Anthony. Jeez.
I'm off message. Off caffeine and off message. That's and then the other big area is in Medicaid, increasing the federal Medicaid payments to states, which would alleviate the burden of states to pick up health care costs for the uninsured and the poorest.
For children, especially, too, right?
Yeah. So those are the two main areas. Governor Kathleen Sebelius of Kansas, Democrat, made the Medicaid pitch. Governor Schwarzenegger made the infrastructure pitch. And both of those elements, there's been a stimulus package passed by the House of Representatives. The U.S. Senate has some ideas of their own, and it looks like it's growing in size. But those two elements, the Medicaid payments and the infrastructure funding as well, are in both versions. So something is likely, although the budgeteers here say they're not counting on federal money.
I was going to say, I think just quickly, two things that are worth watching. One is how fast any of that could happen. And two is the ongoing issue of how much of it should come to California versus other states.
Right.
You know, California for years has said it's not getting its share of anything from the federal government, given its size. But then again, when you look at the total amount of money the federal government might be spending, and you say how much California wants, I mean, there are going to be a lot of other states who are going to be complaining that California would be getting too much if it got what the governor or anybody wanted. So that remains to be seen as well.
Right. And, there is a long line. But you look at the size of the budgets. I mean, you know, all these tales of woe that we're hearing from other states, from Nevada. Nevada has like a $3 million budget deficit.
I talked about that.
You know, it's like, you know, Washington State. It's just I'm not downplaying the severity in the other states, but California is bigger and the size of our hole is bigger as well. So does that entitle us to more federal money? We'll see. But certainly the ask is that much more urgent.
So that's where we'll be watching as the next week comes in. And also to see whether we get any hearings, action, anything in the legislature.
Well, now that every senator is on the budget committee, this should be entertaining. Where are they going to meet?
Yeah, that's true. We didn't talk about that. Daryl Steinberg, the new pro tem, said it was going to be a committee of the whole. All 40 members of the state Senate were going to be on the budget committee. Right. Where are they going to meet? That's, I guess, on the floor. But anyway, we'll see.
I don't know. We'll see.
We'll see. That will be interesting. That and the lighting of the Christmas tree next week.
Did you say a budget committee hearing will be interesting?
No. Well, you know,
you
at this point, what do we count as interesting in California politics
when
all we cover is the budget?
Low. Our bar is pretty
all
low.
We cover is the budget.
Yes.
It's all budget all the time.
And it is a Christmas tree, not a holiday tree. We've confirmed that.
I don't know. Arnold Schwarzenegger's been calling it a Christmas tree in years past.
The outrage.
Someone now will email you about that, Anthony.
Great.
Yes, exactly. Okay. Tell you that you should be calling it a holiday tree.
Email my rabbi.
That and photos of Count Cartaxula to Anthony York at Capital Weekly. That'll do it for this edition of Capital Notes. For Anthony York, I'm John Myers. We'll see you next time.